Welcome to the Nevada Supreme Court. We're here to see the Court of Appeals. We're happy to be here. I'm Judge Michael Gibbons, joined by Judge Abby Silver and Judge Jerome Tao. Welcome this afternoon. We have two cases. The first one is number 66075. And that's Aaliyah, I don't know if I'm saying that right. Versus Sunrise Hospital and other defendants, former defendants. So we have who's going to be arguing?
I am Your Honor, Jamie Collins, on behalf of the appellant.
Okay, thank you. And who's your co-counsel?
Tracy DeFilippo.
Oh, hi. All right. And we have, I see multiple counsel going for the respondents today. And we received a little time chart. It was just revised.
Yes.
And so, is it going to be Mr. Pinebrook first?
Yes.
12 minutes? And Mr. Hopkins? And Mr. Cotton's out?
Yes.
Okay. But this is obviously a very important case, so we want to make sure everybody gets a full argument. And do you want to reserve any time at all, Ms. Combs, for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, all right, you can go ahead and start.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jamie Combs, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Justin and Kristen Ray, individually, who are looking for the courtroom today, and as representatives of the estate of Riley Ray. At this time, I would like to reserve the 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors. This case is about 5-month-old Riley Ray, whose chances of recovering from and beating leukemia were substantially reduced when the defendants negligently failed to admit her to the hospital and begin immediately treating her with aggressive fluids and antibiotics. Your Honors, this court should reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment for two reasons. First, the district court failed to apply the appropriate legal standard, the loss of chance doctrine, and instead applied traditional principles of medical malpractice negligence. Under the loss of chance doctrine, a genuine issue of material fact exists as to whether the defendant's negligence.
Counsel, let me just jump in here. You're for the loss of chance, you're referring to the Perez case, right?
That's correct, John.
Let me ask you a question that everybody should sort of do by the briefing. What makes you so sure Perez is even still good law? It's a 1991 case, the statute was written in 2004, and the summary judgment standard was written in 2005 in Wood versus Safeway. So why is Perez good law at any level?
There has been no Nevada Supreme Court cases, to my knowledge, that have overruled Perez. And subsequent cases, I do believe that...
But the 2004 statute changes, rewrote the definition of medical malpractice. So why would Perez have survived that?
Perez would still survive that because the definition of medical malpractice carried on from the prior case law and codified it. And Perez simply defined the loss as, instead of the death, but defined the loss as not the death, but the reduced chance of survival.
And going to the record on that, even with the alleged deviations of the standard of care upon presentment, what in the record can we point to specifically that show that Riley would have had, quote, a reasonable chance of survival and not have passed away on March 27th?
You know, there are multiple instances in the record which, when viewed in the light most favorable to the appellants, demonstrate that Riley would have had a substantial chance of recovery. First in the record at page 179 is Dr. Bronston's affidavit, in which he testifies to a reasonable degree of medical probability that the breach of the standard of care by defendant Kilpatrick contributed to the death of Riley Ray. There's also his deposition testimony at page 140, in which he testified that to a reasonable degree of medical probability that the dehydration suffered by Riley at her initial visit to the emergency room, which she had already explained was caused by the defendant's negligence, contributed to her death. Again, that's at page 140. Dr. Bronston, that's, again, plaintiff's expert's testimony that aggressive fluids and antibiotics as quickly as possible decrease the possibility of a person going into shock. That's at the record on page 127, combined with the fact that one of the causes of death on Riley's death certificate was listed as septic shock. That's in the record at page 155. Even Riley's treating oncologist, Dr. Klein, we must take his testimony in the light most favorable to the appellants as well. And he admitted that had he seen Riley when she first presented to the emergency room, that on March 24th, 2011, he also would have started her on IV fluids as it appeared she was dehydrated. And the reason for this was simple. You hydrate children with leukemia to get the kidneys to flush out the toxins from the leukemia. That's in the record at page 148 and 150. Dr. Klein also testified that 50 to 60% of the children with this type of leukemia are cured and survived, and that Riley was the only patient he had ever seen that died so quickly within 2 to 3 days of admission. That's at the record at page 147. He also noted, although he disagreed, and that's a factual issue with Dr. Bronston, that it contributed to her death. That's, again, an issue of fact, that he did not believe that it contributed to her death. But he also noted that it was not just the leukemia, but the nature of the patient, which is why she died so quickly. And Dr. Bronston filled in the details of what the nature of the patient was. She was a 5-month-old infant who was severely dehydrated, needed fluids right away, needed testing and antibiotics.
How is he competent, though, to testify as to pediatrics or an oncologist? Why don't please get an expert on, you just get an ER doc who's obviously competent in an emergency room, but not to tie in the survival rate of a patient with leukemia in England.
Well, I don't know why the plaintiffs didn't hire a leukemia expert. However, that is not necessary under the summary judgment standard. Dr. Bronston is qualified to testify as an emergency room physician with more than 25 years of experience that failing to promptly and properly assess a child, especially an infant, who is ultimately diagnosed with leukemia and dies from leukemia and shock, and there are two other causes of death, that failing to do those things is going to contribute to that death. He doesn't need to be an oncologist to be able to testify to that. And we have the testimony of Dr. Klein, who was her treating oncologist, who was able to supply the details of the survival rate, which is 50 to 60% of children typically get better, are able to deal with the toxicity, and are cured from leukemia.
Okay. But you started your argument, and you didn't finish the first point, and you didn't hear the second point yet. It was because of the question. So you said the district court didn't apply a loss of chance doctrine.
That's correct.
And what was the second point in your overview?
The second point was that the district court improperly weighed the testimony of the physicians, of Dr. Bronston and Dr. Klein, and failed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to Riley's estate, the non-moving party. And then if you look at the order focuses on the fact that Dr. Bronston wouldn't testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability that she in fact would have died despite the defendant's negligence, but completely ignored the fact that he did testify that it contributed to her death, and instead relied only on Dr. Klein's testimony, who was the treating oncologist, that he didn't believe that it would have made a difference. And that's weighing the facts. And the district court should have allowed that to go to the jury to weigh whether Dr. Bronston's testimony or Dr. Klein's testimony should be given more weight and should be more persuasive.
So I think their argument, in part, is that Dr. Bronston's not even qualified because he's not an oncologist, and therefore we shouldn't even consider Dr. Bronston's testimony. I think that's one of the arguments they make.
Correct. And to that, to the first point to that, I have 2 points for that. To the first point, that was not actually an issue that was decided by the district court. The district court, in its minutes,
it's in the order. In the district court order, we have it right here, the order granting summary judgment states that right here, the plaintiff's number five claims expert, Dr. Bronstein, testified he cannot provide survival rates for acute myeloid leukemia, and that he would defer an expert in oncology for testimonies to the specifics of that leukemia.
That is in the order. However, when you go down further, the court focuses on the fact that he didn't testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability that the defendant's actions caused his death. And in the minutes, it did state that he would have been qualified, except for the fact that he wouldn't testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability that the defendant's actions caused her death. And that is not the standard. The standard is whether or not the defendant's conduct reduced a substantial chance of Riley's recovery and survival. And under a summary judgment standard, the plaintiffs produced the efficient evidence.
The evidence has to still be through a reasonable medical probability.
Yes,
and that's
Your Honor.
Right out of Perez.
Yes, Your Honor, and he did testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability, Dr. Bronstein, that the defendant's negligence contributed to her death. So when reviewing that statement in the light most favorable to Riley, along with all of the other evidence that I just went through, that tends to show that the defendant's conduct reduced a substantial chance of Riley's
recovery. Well, I mean, Dr. Bronstein, he does and he doesn't. There are parts where he says, yes, I mean, follow my opinions, or a reasonable degree of medical probability, but then there are other parts where he says, well, but it's less than 50% here, and that, you know, it's not really a reasonable degree of probability there. So what's the significance for purposes of summary judgment when the witness gives inconsistent testimony himself? Are you saying that we just ignore the part where he contradicts himself and go with the part that's most favorable to the plaintiff? Is that what you're saying? Or what do you do when a guy says two contradictory things?
Well, I don't believe that he did say two contradictory things. However, I think that we need to view the evidence in the light most favorable to Riley, where I believe you're referencing is when he goes on further in the testimony, the deposition testimony, when he says it contributed to her death.
But he's less than 50% sure of that, or what for the exact word that you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, right. Your Honor. The question is posed to him that you can't state to a reasonable degree of medical probability that it caused his death. And he's saying, no, I can't state to a reasonable degree of probability that it caused her death. But that is not, he's never posed the question, did it reduce her chance of survival? That specific question was never posed to him. So when we look at all of the evidence in the light most favorable, we have to look at the evidence that he did say it contributed to it. He said that fluids and antibiotics immediately need to be given to an infant to prevent them from going into shock. She ultimately died not just of the leukemia, but also of septic shock. We have to view all of those facts in the light most favorable to Riley. Now, for these and the foregoing reasons, I would ask that you reverse the decision of the district court and remand this case for trial.
All right, you've saved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Pringle.
Hey, please support. My name is Mike Pringle. I represent Sunrise Hospital in Rancho Hidalgo. As the panel has brought forward in the question of counsel, the primary question in this case is whether plaintiff's expert has given the requisite testimony to meet the Perez standard. And while the judge Tao's question regarding the applicability of Perez today, I confess I did not consider that Perez was no longer good law, but if this court were to determine that in light of the changes made to the definition of medical malpractice, that Perez is no longer good law, that would be a separate basis to affirm the summary judgment. So moving forward, assuming that Perez is still good law, what plaintiff has to establish via expert testimony is one, that to a reasonable degree of medical probability that there was a substantial reduction in the chances.
So let me ask you this. One of the things you're asking us to do in the briefing is basically to disregard Dr. Bronstein's testimony because it's not admissible in the hallmark. So what that calendar is, and this is an issue that comes up all the time, I don't even know what the answer to it is. It's a motion in limine cloaked inside of a motion for summary judgment. Now normally in the case, as you know, tactically, the motion for summary judgment usually comes first, then the motion in limine on what evidence comes in, doesn't come in, the trial comes in later. And this is something I used to wonder about all the time in the district court. Potentially, the district court could grant, could deny summary judgment based on certain evidence that 2 months later he then rules as inadmissible because it's a trial. Okay, that's a danger that happens because of the sequence of things, but here you have basically a motion in limine inside of a motion of summary judgment. You're trying to say that we shouldn't consider Dr. Blonsky's testimony because he's not qualified under the hallmark. And so my question is, structurally, procedurally, is that something that can be done?
Oh, yes, and I guess I'll address your answer directly, but I want to also highlight that in addition to saying that Dr. Blonsky was not qualified, our first argument, our primary argument, is that accepting Dr. Blonsky's testimony as it is, and assuming that he is qualified, it still does not meet the press standard. But to answer your question, the summary judgment standard is whether we have established or we have brought forward evidence to show that plaintiff cannot meet one of their burdens. And one of their burdens is to, in response to a summary judgment, because we have Dr. Klein's testimony that in his opinion that this delay in initiating treatment did not cause or contribute to her death. So that then puts the burden on plaintiff to come back with admissible evidence that there is a question of fact on that point. So Judge Tal, on your point, at the summary judgment stage, it is completely appropriate to challenge the competency or admissibility of an expert's testimony. But as to the primary point, I believe it was Judge Tal who, toward the end, and maybe it was you, Judge Gibbon, raised the question of, well, Dr. Bronson's testimony is inconsistent. And I will take issue with that. I agree with counsel. Dr. Bronson's testimony is not inconsistent. The problem is that he did not offer all of his testimony to a reasonable degree of length of probability. On the one hand, he says that the conduct of the defendants contributed to the death of the plaintiff. He was then later asked to clarify what he means by contributed to. And this is cited too on page 24 of our brief. And I believe it's page 114 of Dr. Bronson's deposition, where he's explaining what it means to him, contributed to. It is, I can tell you that not doing the things that were appropriate contributed to her death, with the caveat that I can't tell you how long it would have predicted the death, and I can't tell you with a reasonable degree of medical probability how I define it, which is over than 15%, that it would have prevented her death. He's then asked a follow-up question to that. He's asked, assuming everything had been done, as you say it should have been done on March 24th, you can't state that Riley Ray would not have passed away on March 27th to a reasonable degree of medical probability, can you? Answer, correct. So that was the problem with the way Dr. Blonsky was approaching the whole issue. He was kind of giving his thoughts, but he was never stating them to the correct standard. But when he was challenged on what you mean by that, he said, I can't tell you more likely than that. So I don't believe it's inconsistent. It's just he clarifies.
Well, but then at the end, the inconsistency comes in because at the end, he's asked, has every opinion you've expressed today been to a reasonable degree of medical probability? He says, yes. So that seems like it's contradictory in its face, right?
So, but then I guess when we're addressing the summary judgment, we need to weigh whether that last boilerplate comment changes his clarification on what he means by contributing. And I don't think we should. We should be able to rely on what the expert said when he makes the concession that I can't say that this contributed to more likely than not. So, considering the entirety of the testimony, Dr. Bronson simply doesn't give enough testimony to meet the press standard. The other point, and Judge Silver, I think you raised it first, and then Judge Tal talked about it, is whether Dr. Bronson was even competent to give the testimony. And you alluded to, I think, paragraph 6 of the order, where the judge, trial court, at least mentions that. And Dr. Bronson was not qualified. He's an emergency room physician with 30 years' experience. I fully acknowledge that as to questions of standard of care, he's qualified. But on issues of causation for this type of leukemia, he's not. And what the standard is, the hallmark standard, is that by education, training, and experience, he has reason to know these things.
Not only isn't that a question for the trial court, though, because we have summary judgment, we have a record the way it is. And as Judge Tal pointed out earlier, the next step in this case would likely have been a motion in limine to exclude, strike, limit in some fashion.
If Dr. Bronston said, I know I'm not an oncologist, I know I've never treated a patient like this, but I still believe I'm qualified, then you're right. He would have gone to the judge. But Dr. Bronston himself took himself out. He acknowledged that he's not an oncologist or hematologist. He acknowledges he's never treated a patient with this type of leukemia. He really had no idea what the treatment regimen was. He had no idea what the prognosis was. And he says, I'd have to defer to the experts on that. So he took himself out. So but I agree with you that if he, notwithstanding these deficiencies, said, I'm the man, then that becomes an issue for the trial judge to deal with.
What about what counsel stated regarding the septic shock? It's on the death certificate as well that it was also contributed, septic shock contributed to the death. But certainly Dr. Bronstein is competent to testify as to septic shock and it could cause death, which is what he did.
Actually, he did. I don't believe Dr. Bronstein said that Ms. Ray died from septic shock. All that Dr. Bronstein says in a very conclusory fashion is that the conduct of the defendants contributed to death. The closest we have in any testimony comes from Dr. Klein.
Right.
Who did disagree with Dr. Bronstein, where Dr. Klein, who is the oncologist, he's also a pediatrician, says that the dehydration had nothing to do with her death. So is that enough where we have Dr. Klein's testimony versus just a kind of a sentence in the death certificate? Is that enough to establish causation?
The death certificate's by a pathologist. That's a doctor who determined cause of death, that being septic shock. Is that enough to create a question of fact against the testimony of Dr. Klein, who says that the baby didn't die of septic shock? Is that enough to give them to the jury regarding septic shock?
I don't believe so. Here's why. Is that the issue for the 24th, the day of the ER, was not septic shock. It was dehydration. The reason that we had to give fluids to the child was because she was dehydrated. And that's why Dr. Klein disagreed with Dr. Bronstein when he said, and Dr. Klein acknowledged that had he been involved in the 24th, he would have started fluids. Why? Because the child was dehydrated. Not because the child was in septic shock. So, on your point, you're absolutely correct that there was an issue about what role septic shock played in the death. We have nothing tying that septic shock to the conduct of the defendants. All that we have is Dr. Klein saying that I would have given fluids, and so the child would have been less dehydrated, but the child didn't die from dehydration, so therefore it didn't make any difference, is what Dr. Klein says.
But what Ms. Combs was focusing on, she thought the standard wasn't clearly and correctly applied by the trial court. And that what we're really talking about is the chance of survival rather than cause of death.
I will agree that things are a bit muddled because the case as pled, the lawsuit that we have, is not stated as a loss of chance case. It is stated as a medical malpractice case. But the conduct of the defendants caused the death. So certainly the way the court wrote its order kind of tracks that. But very clearly the whole tenor of the argument, the whole discussion and the reason for the rationale the court applied in granting the motion the way it did was on lost chance. But so we need to apply the Perez standard. Do they have an expert who has said to a reasonable medical probability that the conduct of the defendants was substantially reduced by the chance of survival? Dr. Bronstein never even addresses it in those terms. He never says reduces chance of survival. All he uses the term contributed to, so I'm not even sure what that means in this context.
Well, doesn't he also say, my opinion is that she would have lived longer if she'd been treated properly?
He certainly does, but then in the parts that I already read to the court, he then says, but I don't know how long it would have been, and then ultimately,
How long it would have been goes to damages. If she would have been a day versus a month, that's, you've established lots of chance. The difference between a month and a day is the amount of damages you're entitled to.
Absolutely correct. My point, though, is that when Dr. Bronstein was pressed on it, and he says, and this is when he again clarifies this idea of contributed to, he ultimately says, at page 115 of his deposition, which is in the record, in page 140, where assuming everything had been done, As you say, it should have been done on March 24th. You can't say that Larry Wade would not have passed away on March 27th to a reasonably remote medical probability. So now you're questioning him at the correct standard. His answer is correct. So I acknowledge that earlier in the other places in his testimony, he says she would have lived longer, but he never says that to a reasonably remote medical probability. When he's pressed on it, what do you mean by contributed to? He says that's below 50%. So we follow up and say, so you can't say she would have lived any longer. And he says, you're right. So I know I'm running out of time.
You want to save that for Mr. Hopkins?
So unless you have any further questions.
All right, let's then that's a little bit of time. Thank you very much, Mr. Prangman.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jay Hopkins, and I represent Aisha Asif, the respondents in this case. I just wanted to briefly touch on the Perez case, because I spent some time looking at it and was trying to kind of go through the elements of the case, and we've kind of gone over the causation issue, and I think that's been, from a factual standpoint, that's been kind of hit. But what I thought was significant about the Perez case is that it was very clear that the court ruled that the plaintiff had to present through expert testimony that there was a reasonable chance of survival. And that was not done in this case. And interestingly, in Perez, the expert did testify that the plaintiff had a reasonable chance of survival. Now, I think I misspoke there. It's a substantial chance of survival in the Perez case. So that seems almost to be a little bit higher standard. But in the Perez case, the expert did testify that the plaintiff had a reasonable chance of survival. And here we have a disconnect there on this critical element of the loss of chance case. So if we get to the causation argument, and we get to loss of chance, which is really a doctrine to assist the jury or to assist in determining what the damages are because of the reduction in damages for the amount of the loss of chance, we have a critical failure of an element in the loss of chance doctrine. Now, as Mr. Prangman discussed, Dr. Bronson's testimony was pretty clear that he could not testify on any issues regarding AML. And there's a quote out of his deposition that he said, I would have to leave that to another expert. That would not be appropriate for me to get into specifics how long she may have survived or if she would have survived at all, but would have to defer to an oncologist. So Dr. Bronson's testimony does not offer any support at all to satisfy the substantial chance of survival component of a loss of chance case. So, the district court properly ruled on those issues. They were considered in the briefings and discussed at the oral argument. And we would ask that this court affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins.
Your Honor, just a few points on rebuttal. First, I would like to point out some of the similarities between this case and the Perez case. A lot of weight has been being put on Dr. Bronston's deposition testimony, specifically at the end of his deposition, where he's asked, but you can't testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability that she would have lived that day. And he said, to a reasonable degree of medical probability, no, that she would have lived that day. The doctor in Perez couldn't testify to that either. In fact, the doctor in Perez testified that he didn't think that Lopez had more than a 50% chance of survival and that he probably still would have died. However, the doctor in Perez stated that he had a reasonable chance of survival. Now, there was evidence in that case that it was minimal, that this was within a few hours, he had massive brain hemorrhage, and he died. But he said, if they would have started treating him right away, he had a reasonable chance of being able to survive. Here we have Dr. Bronston's testimony that Riley that the failure of the defendants to start immediately promptly treating Riley, doing the proper tests, getting her hydrated, starting her on antibiotics, that these things contributed to her death. And that creates a genuine issue of material fact for the jury to determine whether or not the defendant's negligence reduced a substantial chance of her survival. Second, we also have another issue of fact with Dr. Klein's testimony. Dr. Klein disagreed, and this is in the record on page 150. He disagreed with the cause of death listed on the death certificate that she died of septic shock. That is a question of fact. In Dr. Munston's affidavit, he relies on the death certificate when he comes to the conclusion that the defendant's negligence contributed to her death. That is on page 178 of the record, is the part of his affidavit where he relies on the death certificate in coming to his conclusions. Your Honor, what this boils down to is a question of fact, whether the defendant's negligence reduced a substantial chance of Riley's survival. We have to view all of the evidence, Dr. Klein's testimony, Dr. Bronson's testimony, all of the evidence in the light most favorable to Riley. And the court did not do that in this case. And for those reasons, this court should reverse the grant of summary judgment and remand the case for trial.
Any questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Holmes, Ms. Bigelow, and also Mr. Frango, Mr. Watson. Excellent job, counsel. It's a very tough case. We'll put this matter under submission and have a decision as soon as we can.